COVID and flu cases are up in Chicago following the Thanksgiving holiday. And I'll talk with Crane's residential real estate reporter Dennis Rodkin about the local housing market, including a look at the biggest residential property tax bills in the city.
The way I said it in the story is Cook County Treasurer Maria Pappas just sent new Florida man Ken Griffin a souvenir of his old hometown, a $1 million tax bill.
I'm Amy Guth, and this is Crane's Daily Gist for Thursday, December 8th. At Wintrust Community Banks, you're more than just another account number. No matter your stage of life, Wintrust's dependable bankers are as dedicated to your financial success as you are. After 3 decades of serving communities across Chicagoland, Wintrust has built its reputation on exceptional customer satisfaction and a strong local presence. That's why Wintrust is proud to be ranked #1 in customer satisfaction in retail banking in Illinois by J.D. Power. Visit Wintrust.com/JD Power to learn more about Wintrust's award-winning banking experience. Members FDIC. For J.D. Power 2022 award information, visit JDPower.com/awards. Hi there, and welcome to Crane's Daily Gist Live, brought to you by Wintrust. I'm your host, Amy Guth, and I'm joined by Crane's residential real estate reporter, Dennis Rodkin, here to talk about news of the week from the local housing market. Hello, Dennis.
Hi, Amy. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. Lots of things to discuss. Let's dive right in. So let's start by talking about property tax bills. We have the city part of this to discuss and the suburban part of this. Which one would you like to start with?
Well, why don't we start with the city, because it was the story that came out first.
Tell me about that.
Okay, so as any Cook County resident knows, property tax second installment property tax bills were delayed by several months this year, and now they started coming out just after Thanksgiving. Most people are seeing them, and in many cases, their eyes are popping open. I don't know how many people you've seen on social media, Amy, saying, "Oh, I just got my tax bill and it went up by X," and everybody's surprised. As I do almost every year, I looked at the biggest tax bills that were mailed out, and it may be no surprise to anyone, but it was interesting that Ken Griffin was at the top of the city list of property tax bills. I said here last week, it's not a podcast with the two of us if we don't mention Ken Griffin, and then I wrote a story that has Ken Griffin in it. Ken Griffin, so I put together all of his property tax bills on the condos he still owns in Chicago. Most people know, he, especially people who listen to this podcast, know he moved permanently to Florida this summer, moved both his company and his family, put several condos on the market, sold one, has one under contract, several others still for sale. So the 6 condos that Ken Griffin still owns in Chicago in 3 different buildings have a total property tax bill, including their second installment, of nearly $2 million. He is paying nearly $2 million on condos in Chicago, property taxes on condos in Chicago. That, I mean, you know, most people don't even live in a house that is worth, in a home that is worth $2 million. He's a billionaire. $2 million doesn't matter all that much to him. He's worth something like $50 billion, so a $2 million tax bill, not a big surprise. But the way I said it in the story is Cook County Treasurer Maria Pappas just sent new Florida man Ken Griffin a souvenir of his old hometown, a $1 million tax bill, which would be that second installment, that second half.
Oh, well, what a lovely souvenir. Here's a very huge tax bill. Also, it just occurred to me that we can now refer to Ken Griffin as a Florida man.
Yes, I did. On Twitter, I said, Florida man receives his tax bill. Yeah, I don't know if that's something he would sanction. The other interesting person on the top of the city near the top of the city list would be Governor Pritzker. Governor Pritzker and M.K. Pritzker, the First Lady of Illinois, have a mansion on Astor Street that they bought in, I think, 2007, maybe 2006. And their bill is the 4th highest in the city, $290,502. So Ken Griffin's is, again, that's a combination of 6 units. So he's up at the $2 million level. The Pritzkers at number four are $290,000. The second biggest property tax bill in the city after Ken Griffin's is $562,000 tax bill for the year for Mark and Kimbra Walter. Mark Walter is a principal of Guggenheim, a financial organization, and he's one of the owners of the LA Dodgers. And actually, right after I moved from Chicago Magazine to Cranes, I wrote about the multi-lot house those two were building in Lincoln Park, in that zone where so many multi-lot mansions have been built. It's a giant mansion. I think it's on five lots. It might be on four. And their property tax bill is over $500,000 this year, $562,000.
Well, I haven't seen anyone on social media complaining of a tax bill quite in that zone, but I have seen a few cringes.
You're following the wrong people.
Right.
Or these people aren't on social media. Do you want to talk more about city bills, or should we shift to the suburbs?
Let's shift to suburbs now. I want to talk about those two.
In the suburbs, I did the top 12 bills, and what was really interesting is, as anybody who knows Chicago geography would guess, nearly all of those are North Shore lakefront mansions. Out of the top dozen, there are 11 that are lakefront mansions on the North Shore. The 12th is a fascinating concept. It's a fascinating property. It's in Olympia Fields. It's the former home of R. Kelly, who lost it in foreclosure a decade ago before his legal situation of the last few years, lost it in foreclosure in 2012, and it was purchased not from R. Kelly, but from the foreclosing lender by a member of the Isley Brothers, Rudolph Isley.
Oh.
One of the Isley Brothers' songs is Shout, which I think is probably what Rudolph Isley wanted to do when he got his $246,000 property tax bill this year. The thing there is, it's a big estate, and as people know who follow Cook County property taxes, South Cook County has far higher property tax rates than North and West Cook County because there is far less, I'm sorry, has higher residential property tax rates because there is very little commercial and retail compared to the north and west parts of the county. So while his property may not be the same value as some of these North Shore mansions, his property tax bill is up there at $246,000. Others at the top of the list include Laura Ricketts, a member of the family that owns the Cubs, for a house she built in Wilmette that I wrote about. She's got the seventh highest bill in the suburban part of Cook County. I separated city from suburbs. Her bill is $299,000. Eric Lefkowski, one of the founders of Groupon, and his wife, they're the sixth highest bill. They're at $300,000. And at the top of the list, this is sort of fascinating, the number one bill in the suburbs is Steve and Nancy Crown. They're of the Crown dynasty, a very, very wealthy family of billionaires. Their bill, they have the highest bill in suburban Cook County at $209,000. They are also on the city list, where they also have a bill for $209,000 for a condo they just bought this year on Walton Place. They paid $17 million for a condo that has the seventh highest property tax bill in the city. So they're seventh in the city and number one in the county, or in the suburban part of the county. So they've got sort of townhouse, country house, both big tax bills.
I'm sorry, you said the tax bill number was the same.
Yeah, $209,000, and then the rest of it is not the same. But yeah, they pay $209,000 and then three more digits in both city and suburbs. I'm sure, I mean, it's just a coincidence, but it's just sort of fascinating to think that you have $418,000, nearly $420,000 when you add the other three digits in property taxes on your city and suburban homes.
All right, well, let's go to another story that you wrote recently about how fast-rising interest rates are slowing neighborhood comebacks. Tell me about this.
This was almost certainly inevitable. I have, for the past several years, Cranes has been covering this really interesting wave of rehabs and resales in south side neighborhoods and south suburbs. Properties that were left over from the foreclosure crisis and sold by the Cook County Land Bank to rehabbers, and many other properties sold by the estates of elderly people and others, people who hadn't, or homes that hadn't been maintained, were in trouble physically, scattered across the south side and south suburbs, some in the west side as well. And there was this great rehab wave that was doing, it was really doing a lot to stabilize those neighborhoods, to provide upgraded housing, to upgrade homes that other that the original, the past owners couldn't afford to upgrade. And it was creating jobs, you know, for these rehabbers, for these flippers. Tens of thousands of homes rehabbed and resold. And I was very happy to report over the past several years, it wasn't just, I'm going to flip these houses, oh, this will be great. It was, there was a receipt, there was demand for them. There were buyers. They were flipping these houses, getting them sold. This was a wonderful phenomenon. Well, most of those buyers were first-time buyers. Most of those sales were in the $400,000 and down level. And all that has been zapped by the Federal Reserve's attempt to cure inflation. As everybody knows, Federal Reserve has been raising interest rates. That tends to raise mortgage rates as well. They've risen so fast that first-time buyers have, in many cases, pulled out of the market. I spoke to some rehabbers who said, yeah, I had buyers on the line, or I should say I spoke to the agents for the rehabbers who said, we had buyers on the line for these formerly derelict properties, now rehabbed, looking really good, who walked away. But also, we just don't have the foot traffic of new buyers coming in. And this is, you know, this is a disappointment. This was something that was really doing a lot to refresh the housing stock in these neighborhoods. And maybe I shouldn't speak in the past tense because it's not over. There still are buyers and there still are sales. It's just that it's a far lower level of traffic, of sales volume than there was before. I found over two dozen, just picking through the records, the real estate listings on my own, I found over two dozen of these rehabs that have been on the market for more than 6 months. And I spoke to some agents who said, you know, if they got it on the market last spring, they may have gotten it sold. But those that come on the market now, there's just so much less demand that, first of all, they may not be putting them on the market, or they may sit empty for quite a while. And the one last point about that is some of the agents also told me that you would expect this. With demand down so far, many of the rehabbers, many of the flippers have reduced their activity. They're not buying from the land bank or from elsewhere as many properties. They're banking the properties themselves to do in future years. So we'll see a slowdown of this pipeline that was really a great bright spot in the housing stock of some of our neighborhoods that had been hard hit by the foreclosure crisis of 2006, 2007, 2008.
So it seems like there's kind of two paths for people that would otherwise be putting homes in that pipeline of flipped houses. It's either buy them up and sit on them if you can afford to, or perhaps fewer purchases in the first place.
Well, yeah, and there's a third route, which is flip them to people who will put them in a rental portfolio. You know, a lot of these neighborhoods on the South Side, people don't really like to have out-of-neighborhood rental landlords because the properties, that's how a lot of properties got run down in the first place, and it doesn't keep the money in the neighborhood, et cetera. So selling to rental portfolios is certainly an end or an exit for the flippers, but if there's a lot of that, some of the people in the neighborhoods told me, we may not be very happy about the outcome.
Yeah, well, that'll be another, I think, set of numbers to just kind of keep an eye on and look at.
Yeah, no question.
On the other side. We don't often talk about the American Medical Association here when we're talking about real estate, but nonetheless, a report from the AMA says that there could be a link between abandoned houses and gun violence. Tell me about this.
And this is a segue right out of what we were just talking about, because so several physicians and criminologists and statisticians at the University of Pennsylvania did a study in Philadelphia that has bearing on what's going on in Chicago. They found that abandoned homes have a strong connection to gun violence, and remediating abandoned homes has a strong connection to reduced gun violence. They found that when, again, this was in Philadelphia, but when abandoned homes had their weeds cleaned up and their trash cleared out, but more important, working doors and windows put in so that, you know, it's not an open structure that you can just climb right into. When these properties were put back in working order, there was a direct connection with the reducing gun violence. Gun assaults in the area of these homes went down by 13%, Weapons violations went down by 8.4%. Shootings went down by 7%. And interestingly, they found, they wondered if public drunkenness and drug transactions would go down, but those didn't. So there's a direct connection to reducing gun violence. There is not a connection to those other two kinds of offenses. And this, of course, has a lot of relevance in Chicago. We have abandoned homes. We have troubled properties. Many of them, as I was just talking about, were being fixed up and put back into working order and filled with steady, stable occupants who were buying them up. I talked to a couple of people who deal with abandoned and other distressed housing in the South and West sides, a man named Kanoya Ali on the South side and Jordan Campbell on the West side. They're identified fully in the story, who both said, yeah, you know, these are the kinds of houses when there are a number of abandoned houses in the neighborhood. People realize, well, nobody cares about my neighborhood, and more important, nobody cares about that property. And as one man put it to me, so that's where all my illicit stuff can happen. I can put my drugs in there. I can hide my guns in there. I can run prostitution in there. If I'm a runaway, that looks like a great place for me, an abandoned house, a shelter. And so they tend to attract and, let's say, generate, well, I guess I should say attract, violence. And so it's pretty obvious. We've been trying to clean up abandoned properties, not only in Chicago, but in Chicago and other cities for decades. I put in the story some of the efforts that were happening in the early 1990s. Mayor Daley in the 2010s tried to a whole program of eliminating abandoned properties or fixing abandoned properties as a crime reduction tactic. But the problem persists. The problem is still there. We have thousands of abandoned properties in Chicago and in Philadelphia and other cities. So one of the questions is, can you put some resources into remediating these abandoned homes as a way to help reduce the violence that is plaguing the neighborhoods of a lot of our U.S. cities?
So it really seems like, again, there's kind of two pieces of this. There's the psychological impact of disinvestment and also access for attracting the activities that you described.
Yeah, yes, exactly, yeah. And that psychological issue is, of course, generational. It goes back to redlining and before, where it's pretty obvious nobody cares about my neighborhood. These homes aren't valued. The people who live in these homes aren't valued. And that has a very strong psychological effect. This would be why this would be a study in the Journal of the American Medical Association, right? This would be one of the reasons is that the trauma of gun violence and the related traumas we're talking about from redlining and all the other things that come, disinvestment and all the other things that come with it, certainly is a factor in people's well-being. And then, yes, just simple access to those properties means, as the one man said to me, that's a great place for me to put my drugs or my guns or my prostitution or whatever else I'm going to, whatever other illicit things are going down in my neighborhood, as he said.
That's often the issue with big hot button topics, you know, big issues, is it's not just kind of a one fix and done. There's often all these issues that are not going to be a quick fix, but it is a matter of committing to kind of these long roads through a multifaceted kind of approach in order to fix things like that.
Yeah, I completely agree. And one of the things I should point out, Amy, I said it in the story because I thought it was a very important point. While these scholars found that violent crime was reduced near these homes, they said explicitly that they did not find that fixing up these homes displaces the violence to another area. That they actually saw a drop in violent crime, not, oh, we can't do it at these houses, so we'll go down, you know, a mile away to another neighborhood. They didn't find any evidence of displacement. They felt that there was a strong correlation between remediating abandoned homes and reducing gun violence.
Yeah. So I mean, on the flip side of this, the psychological impact of disinvestment has got to be the psychological impact of investment.
Yes, absolutely. And that is something that has been in some of my stories about the rehab wave and other. Remember, we talked a couple of weeks ago about the two men who used to work for Michael Jackson who were rehabbing homes on the South Side. And they, too, spoke about the idea that, you know, fixing up these houses in many cases, houses, homes, condos as well, that have been run down for decades, for generations, tells people, oh, actually, my neighborhood does matter. I do matter. Somebody is actually pouring resources into my neighborhood. Same concept behind Mayor Lightfoot's Invest Southwest program that Danny Ecker talks about here with you frequently.
Yeah, that's right. I hope we revisit that topic again. All right, well, let's look at some houses. So let's start with a fairy tale animators. Another thing we don't probably mention very often here on this podcast.
No, we don't. So this is a really interesting couple of cottages on one piece of land in Downers Grove. I was kind of fascinated because, you know, often they send me the photos in advance. And I was looking through, and even though they explained, you know, two properties, I could not figure out how this property lays out. So let me lay it out for you. When you arrive at this home, this home, which has this incredibly adorable ingle nook that I am absolutely smitten with, when you arrive at this home, you're looking at a little brick Tudor cottage. If you pass through that house, you go through more garden, and there's a second cottage. And then beyond that cottage, you keep walking through this same piece of ground, the same property in Downers Grove, and there's an old garage, a garage that is actually very attractive. Three cottages, one property, all built in the mid-20s. Main house built in the middle year, probably 1925. Beautiful little place. The living room has a barrel-vaulted ceiling, and it's all finished in rough-hewn concrete plaster. So it, first of all, it absorbs noise, but it looks as if you're in a very old, like a medieval kind of a room, plastered, you know, roughly. This looks like it could be in a storybook. And that's what's really interesting about it is the family who have lived here for the past 51 years, she bought it in 1971 and he moved in 1979. They're animators of fairy tales. They made Rumpelstiltskin, Briar Rose, which is the story Sleeping Beauty is based on, and Rapunzel and several others. They lived in this studio and our building, and they worked in this building, the second one in the back, as their studio. There's a third man. I mentioned the married couple. There was a third man who the wife and the third man were the primary animators. The husband was involved in writing, directing. He's a sound engineer. He did a lot of that sort of thing. The studio was called Somersault. Her last name was Somersault. They're married. Their last name is Motes. And so they had this great life where you live in this adorable, perfectly adorable cottage. And as she said, again, she writes children's books. She animates children's films. This studio, this place which was their studio, was 12 giant steps, a commute from one, you know, which you would expect from somebody like that. Yeah. And then here's the garage out back. And the nice thing is the garage is actually accessed from the next street. So you really have this wonderful, almost bucolic, really storybook setting.
Yeah.
And so that middle cottage that I talked about, that was their studio, but has been redone as a guest house. So it has a full kitchen. It has a bedroom at ground level. It has a sleeping loft above. It's the oldest building on the property. They believe that it was built in 1924 by the home builder who was building the house, built the first cottage as temporary shelter, but then it's still there nearly 100 years later. So you've got this great sort of setup where, again, she said her commute was 12 giant steps. So I said they've lived there since 1971. They did a major rehab in the mid-90s, and I believe that's when they turned this porch into a four-season room. They enclosed it. Just really very nice details throughout. When she bought it in 1971, it was a two-bedroom cottage. Eventually, they had a son. He's growing up. So they finished the attic, which had never been done, into one of the neatest primary suites you could find because there's a bedroom and a bathroom, which all these have. There's a study. And, Amy, in the primary suite, there is a library.
Ooh.
You and I always bond over the libraries.
We always ooh and ah for them.
So it's your bedroom, your bathroom, and right next door, your library with built-in bookcases. So a bedroom that has a library attached, what could be better?
Right. That's bedtime reading is a whole next level of thing. If there's a library in the bedroom. Nice.
Yeah, I love this. And so the entire attic became this primary suite, and downstairs are two bedrooms, the original two bedrooms of the cottage. And then the second cottage has been rehabbed with a bedroom and a sleeping loft. So, you know, you've got all sorts of different arrangements you could do. And so the question is, you know, and they're asking $825,000 for this compound. They're, as I said in the story, they're moving to their happily ever after. Their son is now living in England, and they're selling this to move. They're retired. They're moving there. So who comes in? Are you a family with, say, in-laws who will use that little guest cottage? Are you a family with a couple of teenagers who might live in the guest cottage, 12 giant steps away, which is far enough to get away from your parents? You know, or will you have a home-based business as they had an animation studio? Lots of questions, but just really charming throughout. And in that part of, in the sort of downtown, old town of Downers Grove, they don't call it Old Town in Downers Grove, but the older part where nice, charming houses, beautiful, gorgeous old church right next door to this, and a block away is the downtown strip of bars and restaurants and really a very pretty part of Downers Grove. And this house, I mean, it's hard not to call it a fairy tale cottage when the sellers wrote and animated fairy tales, but I think you might use that term anyway because it's just so charming.
Yeah, it really does have that kind of feel, like it would be in a storybook. You have all the, you know, the stones and the brickwork and these cute little windows. And that it's kind of this little compound, as you said, with, you know, all this landscaping around it. It does feel kind of cozy and fairy tale-like.
One of the cool things about the garage apparently was on a different part of the lot, and it's been moved, and it's got a beautiful shingle pattern. But one of the things that I love is it has a wood floor. I mean, this is how retro this property is there's a wood floor in the garage. Not that anybody should be fearful of that. Like, that's not a deficit that makes you not want to buy the house, because they've been parking their cars on it now for decades.
Mm-hmm. Just a sign of the times.
Sign of the old times.
A sign of the old times, right, right. A date stamp, sort of.
Yeah. Oh, that's a great way to put it. I'm going to use that in the next story on an old house.
Please
Thank
do.
You.
Free ideas. There you go.
Thank you.
All right, so let's go to Glencoe now and talk about the highest price home of the year might be seeing a fate. Tell me.
Yeah, so this house sold in 5 days. It's on the lakefront in Glencoe. It was listed for just under $6 million, $5.999999, and sold, went under contract in 5 days in November, closed just recently, and I called the buyer's agent, who said that he said, I believe it's going to be demolished. I called to find that out. He didn't want to say anything beyond that. I called to find that out. I had a couple of clues. One was there were no photos of the interior. And another was that it sold very, very quickly, which often for a house on the lakefront in on the North Shore often means that it's a teardown. And it's also, you know, it's not unattractive, but it's not something that makes you go ooh-ah. It's got that 70s real shallow mansard roof look. You could update it, but I had a strong suspicion that it would be demolished. And I haven't yet confirmed that it will be demolished, but the agent said, I believe it will be demolished. I don't know yet who the buyer is, but it is one we'll watch. This sold for, as I said, just under $6 million. Highest price in Glencoe so far this year, certainly not the highest price in the market. As you know, we had a sale at $20.5 million is the highest of the year. But it's time for my counter where we count the high-end properties. So continuing with that $4 million line, as anybody who's heard me rattle this off before may recall, in the 5 years prior to the pandemic, the average number of $4 million sales in the Chicago housing market, Chicago and suburbs, was 51. In 2021, we saw 101 sales. So far in 2022, we have seen 130, which, you know, we're coming up on three times the old average. I don't think we'll see 20 more sales by the end of December, but 130 sales at $4 million or more, and we used to see 51 sales a year.
And I feel like even, you know, last year when you were getting up close to 100, we were both so stunned that, wow, it's going to be so high, and then here we are sailing right on past that number.
As of now, so all we really print at the end of January, early February, is the top 50. What we will publish for the end of 2022, I believe, will be ending $1 million higher than it did a year ago, which, like, I can hardly believe I'm saying this, but actually I can believe because I've been keeping the spreadsheet all year.
That's right. You've been tracking it all year, indeed. All right. Well, what's coming up in the week ahead? Besides maybe 20 more high-end home sales.
Well, I hope there aren't 20 more high-end home sales because I'm off next week, Amy. So somebody else would have to cover them, or I will in that following week. What's coming up in the next week is I'm just going to be wandering around not looking at real estate, but I'll see you back here 2 weeks from today.
That sounds like a good plan. All right. Well, until then, thanks so much, Dennis.
Thanks, Amy.
Coming up, the Real ID deadline has changed again for air travelers. We'll talk about that and more right after this. The Greater Chicago Food Depository is working to help communities facing an elevated need right now. Decades-high inflation is making it even harder for our neighbors to afford groceries, and food insecurity is above pre-pandemic levels. Children are at greatest risk, with 1 in 4 facing hunger. Let's rise to the challenge, Chicago. Your neighbor is hungry. Give what you can to the Greater Chicago Food Depository at chicagosfoodbank.org.
This is the Crane's Daily Gist with Amy Guth.
Cases of COVID-19 and influenza are up in Chicago, a surge that health officials say is likely due to recent gatherings during Thanksgiving. Crane's healthcare reporter Catherine Davis noted in reporting that the number of new lab-confirmed COVID cases in Chicago was up nearly 50% as of December 5th compared to the week prior, according to health department data. It should be noted that that number does not include at-home tests that aren't confirmed by a lab. And though often lagging indicators, as previously reported, hospitalizations were down 5% and deaths were also down, with fewer than one Chicagoan dying per day from COVID. As of December 1st, Davis reported, Chicago's COVID transmission risk was considered medium level, a metric typically updated on Thursday evenings. More infectious versions of the Omicron variant are growing in Chicago, particularly BQ1 and BQ11. But Chicago's health commissioner, Dr. Allison Arwady, pointed out at a public health briefing this week that these new variants are still from the Omicron strain, meaning the updated booster vaccine protects against them. However, only 16% of Chicago's population older than 5 has had that specific booster. Meanwhile, Davis also reported new confirmed flu cases in Chicago exceeded 1,950 for the week ending November 26th, up from just below 1,300 the week prior, according to the most recent data available. And there were 29 flu-associated ICU hospitalizations over the same period, also up from the week before. Davis also reported that there have been more than 6,800 flu cases since October 2nd. Dr. Arwady said Chicago and other parts of the country are seeing an especially early and severe flu season, and said that in some areas of the country, though not in Chicago, flu hospitalizations have started to exceed COVID hospitalizations. But cases of respiratory syncytial virus, an upper respiratory illness that was surging among children in Chicago and across the country, has started to come down, Dr. Arwady said. The percentage of emergency department visits to children under 5 due to RSV has dropped from just below 6% to below 5% as of the week ending November 26th, according to health department data. And test positivity for RSV dropped from just over 9% to below 6%. Dr. Arwady urged people to protect themselves from illness by wearing masks in public indoor settings, not just to protect against COVID, but also flu, RSV, and other respiratory illnesses. She also urged residents to get all updated COVID and flu vaccines. The $24.6 billion acquisition of Mariano's parent company Kroger, of rival supermarket chain Albertsons, parent company of Jewel Osco, will face an in-depth review by the Federal Trade Commission. Bloomberg reported, citing a statement from Kroger, that the regulator sent a so-called second request seeking additional information on the deal. Such a request lengthens a transaction's antitrust review by months or years, depending on the complexity of the agreement. Kroger and Albertsons are the two biggest traditional supermarket chains in the U.S., but Kroger ranks second in market share for groceries after Walmart. That according to market research firm Numerator. Albertsons is fourth after Costco. Together, the companies operate a combined total of almost 5,000 stores, though they have agreed to divest as many as 375 of them to win regulatory approval. And Kroger suggested in a federal filing that 650 stores was the upper limit. Bloomberg also reported that the merger has sparked opposition from lawmakers, labor unions, and consumer groups over concerns that it will increase food prices already under pressure from inflation. At a Senate hearing last month, nearly a dozen lawmakers pressed the CEOs of both companies over the deal. Kroger said it would, quote, continue to work cooperatively with the FTC and still expected to close the deal in early 2024. Crane's John Pletz reported that United CEO Scott Kirby said he sees signs business travel demand has plateaued, and he joined other CEOs, including Jamie Dimon of JPMorgan Chase, in warning of a looming recession. Pletz noted that Kirby predicted a, quote, mild recession induced by the Fed during an interview on CNBC's Squawk Box. Dimon echoed Kirby's comments, also telling CNBC that inflation is eating into $1.5 trillion in excess consumer savings, which he predicted will run out sometime in mid-2023. Pletz reported that aviation analysts have worried that a surge in consumer travel this summer might not last, and that a steady stream of layoffs and other cutbacks that started in the tech industry might stall the recovery in business travel, which is still about 20% below pre-pandemic levels. So far, airlines have been able to raise fares enough to cover increased fuel, labor, and other costs. Although he was cautious about the prospects for a recession, Pletz reported that Kirby was upbeat about United's business overall, saying, quote, it feels like business travel, and this probably is indicative of pre-recessionary kind of behavior, has plateaued, even though our total revenues are still up. He continued by saying that if he were working off of only United data, he said the word recession wouldn't even be in his vocabulary. Dimon predicted that the Federal Reserve would raise interest rates to 5%, but worried whether it would be enough to tamp down inflation. Pletz noted that economists and business leaders have been debating when the Fed will pull back on interest rate increases, and pessimism about a recession has ebbed and flowed throughout the year, fueled by inflation concerns even as the economy has continued to produce strong job growth. Air travelers now won't need Real ID compliant forms of identification until 2025, the latest extension of security standards that were set to take effect next May. The Department of Homeland Security has repeatedly pushed back the enforcement date for travelers, which was originally set for 2020, citing state licensing agencies' inability to issue new driver's licenses as well as ID cards fast enough during earlier stages of the COVID-19 pandemic. Bloomberg reported that while lawmakers enacted the Real ID Act of 2005 to address recommendations of the 9/11 Commission, compliance has lagged due to federal bureaucracy, state-level resistance, as well as the pandemic. The law set nationwide standards for state-issued licenses and IDs, requiring all applicants to meet the same minimum documentation requirements. Real ID compliant cards are required for commercial air travel, as well as access to some government facilities and nuclear power plants under the statute. Bloomberg reported that all states, Washington, D.C., and most U.S. territories are now issuing Real ID compliant cards. But the pandemic shifted state license renewal timelines and created further delays. As of April 2021, fewer than half of state-issued licenses and ID cards were compliant. The new deadline is May 7th of 2025. TSA had been alerting travelers to the planned May 3rd of 2023 deadline in recent weeks, warning that they'd be unable to board flights without a compliant ID or a passport. However, the U.S. Travel Association argued earlier this year that sticking to that timeline would disrupt domestic travel. That's Crane's Daily Gist for now. Check in on our continuous news feed at chicagobusiness.com. Thanks so much to today's guest, Crane's residential real estate reporter, Dennis Rodkin. You can follow all of our conversations on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you like to get your audio on demand. Don't forget to subscribe and please rate and review Crane's Daily Gist. Our show is produced by Todd Manley at Earsight Studios. I'm Amy Guth. Thanks so much for listening, and I'll meet you right back here next time.